Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live this week. Last week we played the best of programs because I was away from the microphone, but this week that is not the case. We are live and we can take your calls. And if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, this is an opportunity for you to participate in the conversation. Or if you have an alternate viewpoint and would like to bring that up, we can have a conversation about that as well. All you'll need is a phone number and a phone and a few minutes' time. If you call now, you'll be waiting just a little bit to go on the air because although we do have line open, there are some calls ahead of you. But it's still good to get your foot in the door. Now, I should warn you that sometimes I forget to mention this and people make this mistake. If you happen to be put on hold and it looks like you're going to be waiting a long time, or you're going to have to stay at your phone. I know the temptation is great to set the phone down and go do some things and listen on the radio and wait for your voice to be called, then to run over to the phone and pick it up if you're on hold here and I call your name over the air. The problem is that just doesn't work. There's a delay on the program coming across the air, and I'll be calling your name. If you're listening to the radio instead of your phone, I'll be calling your name probably about 60 seconds before you ever hear me do so, because that's how much of a delay you're looking at. So if you are on hold, please stay on the phone. And of course, you can put your phone on speaker and get, you know, have some more mobility, but don't go away from the phone, because that's where you'll know when I call you to say, hey, what's up with you? And what's up with you, Arthur, from Portland, Oregon? Good to hear from you.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to know if you could tell me anything about the progression of the covenant or the two covenants, reading from the very beginning of the Bible to the end of the Bible. I noticed that there's this progression, and it's very nuanced. And for example, like in Deuteronomy 31, when the Lord describes the Sabbath, He says this will be an ordinance that goes on forever. But when the Messiah comes, He shows the Pharisees that his father is always working, including on the Sabbath, and so he also must work. And so I just wanted to see if there was, I don't even know if you understand my question, but I just want to know if there is either a passage of Scripture or some passages of Scripture or a whole book that could help me keep in mind as I'm reading this, as I'm reading these things, as I'm going from the Old Testament to the New Testament.
Oh, okay, I could work on that. There are two major covenants. Now, in dispensational circles, they say there are seven covenants, and there certainly are many agreements that can be found in the Bible that could be called covenants. But if we're talking about covenants by which God has instructed man how to approach him and how to worship him, and yeah, how to be his people,
right?
There are two covenants. One is the covenant that he made at Mount Sinai, which includes Deuteronomy, which you mentioned. The other is the new covenant, which Jesus made with his disciples in the upper room. And when he said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, and which was, of course, predicted even by the prophets of the old covenant, especially Jeremiah and Ezekiel, who talked about another covenant that God would make. So there are the two. Now, the relationship between the two is what? It's the second covenant, the new covenant, is simply the maturing and the fulfillment of the first. In the Old Testament, God anticipated the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of the kingdom of God under the Messiah. This kingdom is God's eternal purpose and God's eternal plan for the ages. Now, in the Old Covenant, he had not yet established it through the Messiah. The Messiah had not yet come. But he promised it in the prophets, and actually all the way back in Genesis, he promised it, even in Genesis chapter 3. But one of the ways that he promised it was to give rituals to Israel to foreshadow this spiritual covenant. These rituals were not spiritual at all. They were strictly things that you would mechanically do at a temple with animal sacrifices. They were, ceremonies that you'd perform, but they were symbolic, and they represented spiritual things. And this, Paul says, this was like a schoolmaster to bring us to Christ. It was a shadow of things to come. He said that in Galatians 4 and in Colossians 2. And so the old covenant ritual was depicting in advance something that God was promising to come in the future, a spiritual kingdom under the Messiah. So that ritual included special days that were to be regarded as holy, special places and people and buildings and animals that were regarded as holy. It included clean and unclean conditions that a person could be in, and so forth. All of these things had nothing to do with spiritual reality except that they foreshadowed it. They were not spiritual things themselves. They were just rituals. And so when the new covenant came, those rituals passed into their anticipated form. So that, for example, God had told Abraham that circumcision would be an ordinance forever for his descendants. But in the New Testament, we read that it's circumcision, that's a physical ritual, has been subsumed in its spiritual circumcision, the circumcision of the heart. In the Old Covenant, God told Solomon that God would be worshipped in Solomon's temple forever, and that the Levites would serve God forever as priests, the sons of Aaron. Now, of course, that's been defunct for 2,000 years now. There's no temple. There are no Levites,
right.
At least, but they foreshadowed something. They foreshadowed the temple of the Holy Spirit, which has come. They foreshadowed the kingdom of priests, which is what Christians are. Same thing with the Passover and tabernacles and Sabbaths and new moons. These and clean and unclean laws. These were all rituals that foreshadowed something spiritual. And I don't have time to go into all that, what that is now, but the point here is that many of these things were said to be eternal. Of course, many of them don't exist anymore. The things that were said to be eternal, whether it's circumcision or the temple or the Aaronic priesthood, they were eternal, but they're not here. At least they're not here in their ritual form. Mm-hmm. One could argue that they continue in their spiritual form.
In their anticipated form.
In their anticipated form, right. So that the phenomenon that God was describing, or the spiritual reality that was depicted by those rituals, has continued and will continue forever.
So the Sabbath exists in another way, and circumcision exists in another way, in
exactly.
The way that it was meant to be in the future, and we're in that future right now.
That's what I believe, yes, that's what I believe. Now,
okay.
Sometimes people bring up what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, which says, "Don't think that I came to destroy the law. I did not come to destroy the law or the prophets, but to fulfill them."
Mm.
And so some people say, well, if we don't have to keep all these laws because of Jesus, then Jesus destroyed the law. No, he didn't destroy it. He fulfilled it. And the way I understand it is that the law anticipated these things, and he brought about their fullness. It's just like a child, the birth of a child anticipates eventually someday an adult. A child grows into an adult if all things go well. And when the adult comes, the child is no longer there, at least not as a child. The same person is there.
Right.
The child has not died, but he's matured into what was anticipated, an adult. You won't find a child there anymore. You'll find an adult there now, because that's what was anticipated by the child, by the child's very existence. And Paul, in Galatians 4, likens the law of the Old Testament and its rituals to childhood. He says, when we were children, we're kept under rules and ordinances and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But when faith came, we're no longer under those things. And so he speaks of us coming to Christ as coming to maturity in one sense, that the law was, and the old order under the law, was a good thing, just like a child is a good thing. But if a child never grows up, that's not good. There's something
right.
not healthy. And the law was good, but if it was never, if what it anticipated never had come, that wouldn't have been good. But once it has come, for people to try to hold on to the child when there's now an adult, for example, mothers sometimes do that to their grown children. They try to treat them like they're little children. They try to control their lives, and they won't recognize that they've grown up and they're adults now. That's how some people are about the law, They don't recognize that, okay, we're grown-ups now. the perfect has come. The spiritual reality has come that was anticipated by the childhood of the law. So we don't want to keep holding on to the childhood. Let's go on to maturity, as the writer of Hebrews says.
Mm. So does Paul just participate in these things simply for the benefit of the people around them?
Yes.
Around him?
Yes, and he said so. He even said that that's why he did it. If you read 1 Corinthians 9, he says, you know, I'm free from all men, but I make myself a servant of all. He said, to those who are under the law, I behave like one who's under the law, so I might win them. And when I'm with those who are not under the law, I behave as one who's not under the law, so I might win them. I become all things to all men, that I might win some. And so Paul is saying, you know, you will find me keeping the law when I'm with people who that matters to. Not because it matters to me, but because reaching them for Christ matters to me. And I'm trying to connect with them at their cultural level. So that's why when Paul went to Jerusalem and James said, you know, the Christians here in Jerusalem, they're really zealous for the law. And so we want you to sort of act like you're zealous for the law, too, and go and pay the fees for these Nazarites. Paul did it without complaining, because that was, in fact, his policy, to blend in as much as possible insofar as it did not require him to sin. So when he was with the Gentiles, he didn't keep the law because he was under no obligation as a Christian to do so. But when he was with Jews, he knew that mattered to them, and so he graciously, complied and conformed. And, you know, some people say, well, then he was being disingenuous. You know, he was deceiving them. I hardly see how it could be deceptive when he himself tells us that that's his policy. I mean, it's not like he's secret about it. He says
right.
In 1 Corinthians 9, this is what I do, you know? So it's not too much of a problem.
Is there a line that we should not cross when either abstaining from certain things or not, like bounding ourselves by the law for the sake of other folks, or, I don't know, acting like barbarians for the sake of other folks?
You know, I suspect that there is definitely a line that has to be drawn on the side of legalism, that if somebody you're trying to reach is just totally like a total legalist, and you feel that by complying with that, you're only encouraging, you know, this evil of legalism, that you're basically affirming it, then I would say a Christian in good conscience would say, I'm sorry, I can't follow you there because I don't think this is healthy.
And the opposite would be true too, right?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When you're with Gentiles, when Paul was with Gentiles, he was with people in a culture where they slept with prostitutes in the temple and they got drunk regularly and they worshiped other gods. And certainly when Paul says that when he's among those who are without the law, he behaves like those without the law, he doesn't mean in those respects. In fact, he even qualifies it. In the passage in 1 Corinthians 9 I'm talking about, he says, when I'm with those who are without the law, I live as without the law. Then in parentheses it says, yet not being without the law to God, for I'm under the law to Christ. So, he qualifies it. He says, you know, I'm not under the Jewish law. So if I'm with people who eat pork, I can eat pork with them because that's not a sin. If there's a leper in the next room, I don't have to stay out of the house because I don't have to worry about being made unclean. That's all the law. But if they say, hey, let's go out and turn a few tricks with some whores, then I'm under the law to Christ. Christ is not in favor of that. So I can't do that.
Right on. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, good talking to you, Arthur.
All right. You too.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
Okay, let's talk to Michael from Live Oak, California. Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you again. I know
yeah.
You were off last week. Anyway, over the years, I've tried to communicate the Buddhist understanding, which is so different, at least seemingly,
it is.
From the Christian perspective. And I think that I fall short of being able to do that effectively. I know there are some people that I, in Santa Cruz and elsewhere that I know who dabble in Eastern religion and so forth, and not everyone really has, even those who are somewhat familiar with these types of teachings, has a clear understanding of what it is saying. And like you have asked me many times, why don't you just accept Christ as Lord? Why do you believe in God and so forth? And to really address that question, I have to give a little bit of, and hopefully a brief explanation as to how the what the Buddha said about reality.
Okay.
And that, in a nutshell, you probably haven't heard of Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna was a Buddhist philosopher and practitioner back maybe 1,000 years ago, and he had consolidated the basic message of the Buddha in what he called the middle way or Madhyamaka philosophy. And he used a very famous example of the chariot, and we can update it to a car in the modern age. But so you take a car and you try and find the essence of the car. What is labeled as car is a collection of parts and wheels and engine, the cylinders and so forth, and the frame. But it is not one part of it that is inherently the car. The car is a designation on a basis of things functioning in a certain way.
Okay.
There's no inherently existing car. It's an interdependent collection of components that function, and then the label is overlaid on a car.
Okay.
Likewise, with everything, including a human being, the person is an imputation on a basis of psychophysical aggregates or components of body and mind. And so a person or self is ultimately a conception. It's an imputation on what seems to be a fixed static entity, but it's actually a very fluid process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like that with everything across the board. There's no thing that you can set aside and say, this has absolute existence. It's all arising on interdependent factors.
Unless, of course, there is something that has absolute existence, or are you saying only in the human person?
No, everything arises what Buddha called interdependent origination.
Okay.
So you look at the tree, and that depends on the soil and the water. It's not an independent phenomenon.
Okay. Well, are you saying that the creation then created itself, or do you believe there's a creator?
Then that, of course, was an ancient question in India. You know, in some of the Hindu schools, they do posit a creator or a trinity, their own trinity of Brahman and Vishnu and Shiva, the creator, the sustainer and destroyer. But even that is understood as cyclical. So the cycles of existence are there's no absolute beginning. It's actually said to be beginningless. You have a period of existence and then dissolution and then dormancy and then creation. But and the Buddhist view would probably generally agree with that. They see the universe as self-existing because it's not ultimately in time.
Okay.
The sense of creation is a perspective based on a time-oriented frame of reference.
Let me jump in here.
Sure.
And say something, Michael. You said at the beginning of your call that you haven't done that well in expressing the Buddhist position. I'm not sure that that's correct. I think you probably have done a very adequate job of expressing it over the years. You and I have had these conversations on the air. But I guess here's the issue. My problem, although I will admit there are things about Buddhism I don't understand, that is a fact, because I haven't really studied it like you have. But my problem is, I don't think, with the matter of understanding it as a matter of seeing why anyone should believe it. And this is the interesting thing. You and I, in some of our conversations, you've brought up how many things there are in common between Buddhism and Christianity, especially probably the ethics of the two religions. And I would say that probably you could bring almost any other religion into that mix and say, yeah, their ethics are very similar, but not in all points. But now you're mentioning, and quite correctly, that there's some huge differences between Christianity and Buddhism. And as I've said in our previous conversation, I think those differences are where we really have to focus our discussion, because we don't disagree probably very much on what is right and wrong behavior toward our fellow man. You know, we, for the most part, we'd probably be about 99% in the same camp on how we should treat each other. Okay. The question is these big differences about worldview, about ultimate reality, about whether there's a creator God or not, and whether he's personal or not. These are the big worldview issues that need to be discussed. Now, what I've tried to get across to you, and not in all of our conversations, but certainly in quite a few of them, is that I'm looking at this a little, I think, a little differently than you are. And it may not be obvious that I am, but from a fundamentally different place. Because in our conversations, you often say, well, the Buddha says, or the reason I don't accept Christianity is because the Buddha says this or the Buddha says that. Well, obviously, it's clear that the Buddha did say a number of things that would be different than what Christian scriptures say. And it may be that, you know, if I said, you know, I believe such and such a thing because Augustine said it, then I would not be true to my commitment to find the truth, because I don't think that Augustine, though he was a Christian saint and philosopher and theologian, I don't think Augustine is the ultimate arbiter of truth. I think God is. I think God's word is. I think Jesus Christ is, because he is God's word in the flesh, at least as I have come to be persuaded that he is. So, in other words, if you say, well, the Buddha says such and such, and I said, well, Augustine said such and such different, I feel that we'd be arguing on exactly level ground. You have every right to believe what Buddha said if I have the right to believe what Augustine said, because Buddha was a man, a philosopher, a philosophical man. Sure, he claimed to be enlightened, but I'm sure Augustine and many other Christians claim to be enlightened too. They might have different definition for what enlightenment is, but the truth is, in the end, they're all philosophers. Buddha was a philosopher, Augustine, Aquinas, C.S. Lewis, they're all philosophers. As much as I may appreciate many things they said, I would never appeal to them as the authority. I would never say, well, I believe this because C.S. Lewis said this, or I believe this because Aquinas or Augustine said this, because I believe those men could be wrong. I think that those men, though they were Christians and very wise, they still have to, if where they're speaking about things that we cannot see or prove, they need to have some source of authority beyond themselves. Because a mere man, no matter how philosophically brilliant he is, and I say this about Christian philosophers, I highly respect quite a few Christian philosophers who, as I think I said on yesterday's program, you know, they're beyond my they're beyond my pay grade to even understand what they're talking about most of the time. They're so smart, but no matter how smart they are, they're still talking about things that no one can see or prove, and unless they got it by divine revelation, then they're still just philosophizing. The same is true of the Buddha or, you know, any Hindu mystic or Muhammad. You know, these are human beings, and they're not anything more than human beings. They never claimed to be more than human beings. And therefore, if they say, well, such and such a thing is true, whether it's Aquinas or Buddha or Muhammad or anybody who's not a prophet of God, or who is not the Messiah, who is not God's son in the flesh, then they have to appeal to something back of them, behind them, that's a higher authority, because they don't know. I mean, they don't know what none of us know. They have an idea, and we might hear their idea and say, that appeals to me. I think the Buddha really was onto something there. I think what he said is a very self-consistent, insightful thing. Now, we could say that, but in doing so, what we're saying is a whole lot of other really brilliant philosophers of different religions, they're wrong, because Buddha was right. Now, we can do that, but we should have some basis for doing that. In other words, if someone said, well, Buddha makes a ton of sense to me, and I said, well, you know, C.S. Lewis makes a ton of sense to me, and he says opposite things to the Buddha. Well, we could just agree to disagree and say, well, I like what Buddha said, and you like what C.S. Lewis said. Excellent. Let's just be friends. But if we really wanted to know what's true, we'd have to ask ourselves, is there someone more authoritative than C.S. Lewis or Buddha against whose insights, we can check theirs. Now, the Christian view is, of course, that Jesus Christ came down from God, that he is the Word of God made flesh. He is, in a sense, God enfleshed among us, and that his authority is unique among all human beings who've ever spoken on his subject. Therefore, when I read C.S. Lewis, before I accept what he says, I have to check and see if it's in violation of anything Jesus Christ said. Because although I love C.S. Lewis, and he's brilliant, the Bible says if they don't speak according to this word, there's no light in them. And the man can be wrong. The same is true when I hear what Buddha said. You tell me, well, the Buddha said this. Well, okay, I understand that the Buddha said that. I'm not trying to put him down or anything like that. I'm just saying I want to take what he said and compare it with what Jesus said. Because I don't put Jesus and Buddha on the same level any more than I put Jesus and any Christian philosopher on the same level. There's a world of difference between God come in the flesh to speak to man on the one hand and any religious founder or philosopher on the other hand, as far as their authority is concerned. Now, you might not think so, and that's okay. I'm not here to force you to accept my beliefs. But I am saying that when I hear your beliefs expressed, the thing that's always in my mind when you say, well, the Buddha said this is so, or this is the way it's seen, the question in my mind, as an honest person interested in truth, is, okay, that sounds interesting, but why should I believe it? Why should I believe it that Buddha was right when, you know, his views differed from those of many other philosophers? And this is the question I've asked you on many times. You know, Michael, what is it that about Buddha that makes his philosophy, you know, the final court of appeal for you in these matters?
Very good question, Steve. The epistemological basis for coming to the insight that the Buddha described doesn't really have to do with belief per se. Belief might be a starting point, but it's about actually seeing this interdependent nature that he spoke of. So he said through meditation and through following the Eightfold Path and so on, one can gain direct recognition of this truth and therefore be freed from the illusion of separate existence ego.
That actually is more credible than some answers people might have given, you know. But it still has a flaw to me, and that is that you're saying that a Buddhist who really practices the Eightfold Path and so forth is going to get this inward revelation or insight that this is true. You'll get enlightenment. It sounds like that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
But see, Christians say that about Christianity. Hindus say that about Hinduism. Some mystical Muslims would say that about that. Some New Agers say that about whatever it is they're into. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we're left sort of at the place where we started. We've got X number of worldviews, all of which have spokesmen who claim that they are true, and all of them have certain experiences that seem to verify to the believers that they are true.
Steve, let me just try this metaphor. And isn't what verse, I don't remember myself, doesn't it say somewhere in one, either the Old or New Testament, the God shines on those equally, on saints and sinners alike?
Yeah, Jesus said that in the Sermon on the Mount. He said that God causes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good and sends the rain on the just and on the unjust. Yeah.
So just for the sake of discussion momentarily, if we can describe the reality as like the sunlight, that's out there, and all one needs to do is to open to it, to receive it. It's not anything that one would even necessarily have to believe in, but simply experienced by saying, okay, I want to, I'm open to receiving something that maybe I was not interested in before.
Okay. Now, see, what you just said is fine, and it makes sense. But the question in my mind is, why should I accept that particular paradigm you just described? Now, you might say, well, what, Steve? You're being unreasonable. You got to accept something. I do, but if I can accept something and it's going to govern my life, I need to make sure it's gone back to the ultimate source of reality that I know is true. You know, if Jesus said, well, because the sun shines on everyone, people don't have to believe it, they just, you know, have to enjoy its light or something like that, well, then I'd say, You're on it. That's what Jesus said. That's correct. But if Jesus said, if you don't believe that I am he, you'll die in your sins. And he said, you have to believe in me if you don't want to perish and if you want to have everlasting life. If Jesus said those things, then as interesting and even as maybe valid as certain statements you're making could sound, I have to assume that, you know, if they aren't in accord with what Jesus said, then I'm going to say, well, it's a good sounding philosophy, but it certainly doesn't have the foundation, that in truth that I would require if I was going to follow one, a philosophy. Now, of course, someone listening to me who's not a Christian, like yourself, perhaps might say, well, you know, you keep going back to this Jesus. Well, you know, on what basis does he become the arbiter? Well, that's exactly, I'm glad you asked. on the basis of his having proven himself to be who he was, and particularly by his resurrection of the dead, which he first predicted and then pulled off. Some people do come back from the dead in hospitals and stuff, but they don't ever predict they're going to. No one knows they're going to if that's going to happen. But if Jesus said, okay, this is the plan. I'm going to die, and in 3 days I'm going to rise again. You'll see me again then. I'll meet you here. You know, and then he does it. He dies, and then he comes back. This, he says, proves that he, you know, the fact that he could make a prediction and pull that off proves that he knows what he's talking about. Now, of course, if someone said, well, I'm still skeptical. Well, okay, people can be infinitely skeptical about everything. It's sort of like when a kid comes to his mother and says, well, why is the sky blue or whatever? And she gives a reason, and then he says, well, why is that? And she gives another reason, and he says, well, why is that? You know, you can go why in an infinite regression and never stop. And a person can be infinitely skeptical and say, well, here's the reasons that Jesus, here's how he's proved who he is. And someone can say, well, I just don't accept that. Well, good. I'm not going to argue the point. I'm just going to say that's the way it is. I'm a person who has to make my own judgments about what common sense would dictate. And common sense dictates to me that if a man comes who was prophesied for hundreds of years before he came by the inspired prophets, who had also prophesied many other things that came true and therefore had credentials, and they prophesied that this man would come and do certain things, and here he comes and he does those things, and then he himself does the works of God, raising the dead, healing the sick, casting out demons. The demons recognize him who he is. They say, we know who you are. You're the Son of God. And then he says, now here's the climax of my show. I'm going to die and I'm going to come back again and you'll know who I am. So, and then he does it. Now, I mean, I could say, well, I still want more than that. Well, okay, I, no matter what he does, I might want more than that. But the truth is, I have to live with the evidence that's been presented. Is it convincing? I find it very convincing. And of course, then I've got another aspect. I know him, you know, because he is alive, because he rose again, he actually can be personally known. And I've known him for over 50 years. And we have a relationship. But I wouldn't use that alone, my relationship with him, as the proof of Christianity, for the simple reason that you could come back and say, well, I have enlightenment through Buddhism. So there, you know, in other words, I do have a relationship that confirms my beliefs. And you have apparently an experience that confirms yours. But my beliefs actually have a historical foundation that makes it almost illogical to reject Jesus. And whereas I could reject Buddha without being illogical. I'm not saying anything bad about Buddha. I'm just saying I could reject him, and I wouldn't have to go against the evidence to do so, because there's no evidence.
Steve, I know we're running out of time, but very quickly, let me just cap off by, my knowledge of the New Testament is very limited. I have not read it from cover to cover, but I have focused in on the actual teachings. I used to have the red letter version. So I know. When he was dealing with people, you know, he said to the adulteress, go and sin no more, and other people, just, you know, live with integrity, live from your heart.
Very true.
And I didn't necessarily hear him saying, and again, I admit that I'm not well-versed in the whole New Testament teaching, but I did not hear him saying to his disciples when he was among them, you need to believe in me, and only through believing in me will you be saved? I just didn't get that.
Well, you may not have read the whole New Testament,
right.
But the part of the New Testament that would help you best in this particular point would be the Gospel of John. You see, the three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have lots of the ethical teachings of Jesus, but not very much of his philosophical teaching. Mm-hmm. Not very much of his theology. There's not much theology in his teaching in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's more ethical. But in John, he actually got locked into some theological discussions with the theological people, the Pharisees and so forth. And that's where his theology is really comes out more. And so if you're interested in what he said about that, the need to believe in him, the book of John would be definitely the right place to look. You know, Michael, I love you, and I've got to move along because we've talked, frankly, a very long time.
Sure, Steve, no, that's fine. I'll talk to you again, I'm sure.
All right, Michael. Thanks for your call.
Bye
now. All right, David from Santa Cruz is our next caller. And by the way, welcome to The Narrow Path. If you'd like to be on the program, there's a line open at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. David, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm just addressing the question about the Sabbath with not just the caller, but the one before him.
Yeah.
And every time I've heard a discussion about the Sabbath, I've never seen anyone quite understand the distinction between the ceremonial Sabbath and the Sabbath that's on the Ten Commandments that are not typical, you know, written by the finger of God, that type of a thing. And I don't know, I've just seen the general idea that if you are keeping the seventh-day Sabbath, that there's a certain idea that there's legalism involved with that or something like that, as opposed to it just being the commandments of God written by the finger of God is now written upon the human heart and human obedience. Is there a distinction in your mind between the Sabbath of the ceremonial typical system and the Sabbath of the Ten Commandments?
Well, in my mind, there's not. In my mind, the fourth commandment, which says to remain at rest on the seventh day, is a ritual law. And it was repeated many, many times in the Pentateuch, and of course enforced even the prophets, you know, talked about it, the need for it. But when I say ritual, I'm not necessarily referring to a whole bunch of traditions that the rabbis added to it, though there were those. There were plenty of ritual traditions. When I talk about ritual laws, I'm talking about the actual laws in the Bible which have a ritual basis rather than a moral basis. Now, there's nothing in the Bible that says the Ten Commandments, all those commandments have a moral basis. A moral basis would be a basis which has to do with love, that has justice, mercy, faithfulness, and so forth. These are the moral issues that the moral laws conform to. Whereas ceremonial laws or ritual laws are those which have a certain arbitrariness to them. I'm not saying they could be entirely arbitrary because they are intended to point forward to something, and there's not infinite flexibility as to how they could be conducted to point forward to those specific things. But I would say that when you have God saying, I want you to keep three festivals a year, it's obvious that God, without doing any violence to his own nature, could have said, I want you to keep five ceremonies a year. Or two. In other words, if God could have given that law slightly differently, then it isn't moral, because God cannot compromise on righteousness. He can compromise on symbolic duties that he wants to assign to people, because it's his business to symbolize whatever he wants to in whatever way he wants to. But, for example, God could not say, thou shalt commit adultery, because doing so would be a violation of his own character. And God cannot sin, nor would he instruct people to sin. So the command against adultery or murder or stealing, these are all cases where God could never command people to do those things because they would be unjust and they would be contrary to his holiness. Now, for him to say, keep the Sabbath day separate and don't work on it, he's got every right to give that command, just like he's got the right to give the command that you have to bring your sacrifice to the tabernacle instead of offering it, you know, in your backyard. But it's a ritual, and it could have been done differently. God could have said, you know, I'm going to make three tabernacles for the sake of geographical convenience, and you can go to any of them. Instead, he made one. But he could have made three, and it wouldn't violate anything in his nature. He could have said, I want you to rest on the sixth day instead of the Sabbath day, because the sixth day is the day I made man. But instead he said, I want you to rest on the Sabbath day because that's the day I rested. He could have said, I want you to rest on the ninth day because of whatever else he wished to commemorate from the ninth day, if there was something. The point here is, if the law could have been given differently than it is, if the opposite of what is said could have easily been said without violating God's character, then you're not dealing with a moral issue, because God's morality cannot be violated. But rituals have a certain arbitrariness to them. That's what I believe. So, for example, when God said, okay, I want these, this condition, a woman who's had a menstrual, her cycle, I want her to be unclean for 14 days. He could have said, I want her to be unclean for 15 days or 21 days or 8 days or whatever he wanted to. In other words, this is a ritual thing. It's not a moral issue. It's a matter of ceremony. And that's what the Sabbath falls into. And that's why Paul and Jesus both place the Sabbath into the category of ritual law. When in Matthew 12, when the Pharisees criticize Jesus' disciples for working on the Sabbath, he said, haven't you heard what David did? And he justified what his disciples did by comparing it with what David did when he ate the showbread. Well, certainly eating the showbread is not a moral issue. It's a ceremonial violation. And then he gave the example of the priests that offer the sacrifices on the Sabbath. Well, that's a ritual thing, too. Obviously, he was making the violation of the Sabbath to be a ritual violation, like David's, rather than a moral violation. Like, for example, when David killed Uriah and married Bathsheba, that'd be a moral violation. But to violate the showbread is a ritual violation. So Jesus equated Sabbath breaking with ritual breaking, and he justified his disciples, said there's some flexibility there. It's okay for them to do that. And Paul did the same thing in comparing the Sabbath with other rituals. In Colossians chapter 2, verse 16, he says, don't let anyone judge you with respect to what you eat or drink. He means, dietary laws, kosher laws, or festivals. That's the three feasts during the year that the Jews had to keep, or new moons, which were a monthly celebration, or Sabbath days. He says, don't let anyone judge you about whether you do those things or not, because those were a shadow. Those were a shadow for the time being, but the substances of Christ. So, as I understand it, Jesus and Paul both linked the Sabbath with other ritual laws and never linked them with moral laws, as near as I can tell. And that's for obvious reasons. If they had said nothing about it, we could have concluded that deciding that a certain day should be kept is God's prerogative, of course. But it would be equally his prerogative to make it the sixth day or the fifth day or the eighth day as the seventh. There's nothing morally binding upon God to order the Sabbath, whereas all the other commandments in the Ten Commandments were morally binding. They're different in character. Now, you mentioned, the Ten Commandments were written by the finger of God and on stone, and my impression is that you're saying that makes it different. It does make it different, but it doesn't make it different in the way that I think you're suggesting. Just because something's written on stone instead of on parchment doesn't make it any more or less a command of God. And when Paul was talking about the old covenant that's passing away in 2 Corinthians 3, he referred to it as the covenant written on stone was passing away. So he was obviously referring to the Ten Commandments and the covenant there. So anyway, you asked if I make a difference between the Sabbath in the Ten Commandments and the ritual Sabbath. I personally don't. I know many people do. And if they want to do that, I don't, frankly, more power to them. I don't have any, I'm not going to go after them and try to get them to do something different. But if they start judging me for not following their way, Paul says I shouldn't let them judge me about that, because it's really not an obligation, according to Paul. I appreciate your call, though. Let's talk to Charlotte from Reno, Nevada. Charlotte, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate this opportunity to ask for prayer as well as wise counsel. I know that my time is short, so I will try to focus on what is important. I apologize. I'm not really calling from Reno, but he needed to give a city, and my name really isn't Charlotte. I'm giving that as a cover to protect my family.
Okay.
The bottom line is I have known the Lord loves me since I was 3. I was a missionary to India. I better not say more, or I'll disclose my identity. But my son was hit by a car and had to have spinal reconstructive surgery. I wanted to help him and his future fiance, so I helped him buy a condo. When the prices were low, we got it like a third of the price and fixed it up. And we spoke to two of the men who had worked with you with NeuroPath. I bought a second bedroom because I bought it in a retirement area that's really, really nice by the mountains. And I spoke with the, it's a large library where they said that they have a 35 seat room, a 45 seat room, and a 150 seat room. So as the Bible study grew, they could move it to there because we got a second bedroom. The Lord has been working behind the scenes in your life. This has been going on since 2011. It took us about a year to save the money and fix everything up and then get furniture. I contacted them. Unfortunately, you were in Washington for the summer, so we weren't able to start it then. And then you weren't coming here in the fall.
Well, okay, Charlotte, you have to realize I don't know where here is because you told me you're in Reno and then you figured out. So
I can't say that, right? I'm telling you that. I'm just letting you know that.
Okay.
But there was an ulterior motive too, is because it wasn't only a place for him to stay while he finished at the university, but then after he finished at the university during those 2 years. We were hoping that you, we even had a veteran that was going to fly you here and your wife back and forth so you could come here once a month and have a Bible study. Well, and while we were waiting to be able for you to get down in Washington State and then for you to come here to present you with all of this, I stayed there with them because they had to have the water heater. Well, and I know because I was there 24/7. I noticed suspicious activity at the condo next door, which their garage is underneath. And the bottom line is, I'm 99% positive they're trafficking cocaine. I've warned them. I've called the HOA. I've called the police, and the situation has. It's out of hand now because they have, when they bring in a big load, they have two men on each corner, really rough looking, you know, men, big men, and it's males in their 30s, 40s. And now they've installed some type of system so they can see, you know, if we're at home. They've been drilling holes in the walls. This all sounds crazy, but I need the name of somebody that's a Christian, that's a FBI agent or DEA agent or undercover policeman to come in that I could trust to come in and stay there and confirm, because I started keeping surveillance. Keeping the tags of those coming and going. But now it's not safe because they started following my son to school. And so I contacted a realtor to sell the home.
Okay, Charlotte.
And, so I can get my family out. But I have the moral dilemma. I feel I have a responsibility to tell whoever purchases it what's going on.
I understand.
And so I'm just asking for you to pray and not answer, not to give me advice today, but I'm renting my car on Friday so I will have access to a radio so I can hear your response. And for today and tomorrow and Thanksgiving, if my brothers
Charlotte, let me jump in here because we're going to run out of time.
Okay. If
don't wait till Friday.
Give you advice and then you answer on.
I'm going to have to turn you off so I can speak before we run out of time here. You're in a very desperate situation, and I understand that. You're afraid, and there's reason, probably, naturally speaking, to be afraid. Although, of course, Christians realize that we have resources that are beyond the natural, but it looks like the natural resources that are available are not coming through. It sounds like you've called the police and they either, I don't know why they haven't done something about it. Maybe they're on the take, who knows. But, you know, I agree that you should probably sell the place if you can. And I don't have any question in my mind about the ethics. You would have to tell any prospective buyer what you believe is going on downstairs. And that is going to definitely limit the number of people who would be interested in buying your place. I wouldn't want to buy it if that's going on. And I don't know of any way for you to get out of the situation. It is definitely something to be praying about. And I hope our listeners will be praying about the situation, because it looks like it's going to take probably an act of God to clear that activity out of there. Now, I'm not sure if you've gone to the FBI. You said you've called the police and 911 and so forth, or maybe you're afraid to do that. I understand that, too. I mean, these are pretty rough characters in all likelihood. And I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on law enforcement, but obviously the right solution is for law enforcement to get in there and clean that out. If they don't, then you're in a very hard spot that I do think, you know, we should be praying for you about. But if you're asking about an ethical dilemma, I do believe that if somebody is going to be wanting to buy your house, you should definitely tell them anything negative about it that they would need to know. And that's going to probably drive away 9 out of 10. Although, who knows, maybe you'll get a drug dealer that wants to buy your house. I'm not sure. Anyway, it's a horrible situation, but it's not something that a talk show host is going to be able to do much about, I'm afraid. I don't know any Christian FBI agents, and I think you ought to probably do some research along those lines, probably through avenues that are more likely to turn something up. If since we don't even know what geographical area you're in, that limits us too from knowing, you know, how to deal with your situation. It's a sorry thing to hear such a plight that you're in. But I honestly, if I was in your situation, I wouldn't know what to do either, except to put it up for sale and to pray that God would bring along a buyer who, for whatever reason, wouldn't be afraid to buy that house or that condo. Or, of course, I'd also be praying that law enforcement would do something on it, because that's really the ideal solution. But if law enforcement doesn't come in, I'm not sure what to say. I certainly wouldn't, if I were you, want to anger the drug dealers who might do harm to you or your son. So I can understand your fear. I'm just saying that I'm not particularly able to do much about it or intervene in any way. But and law enforcement's going to have to do that, unless you can just get out of there. I can advise you, I believe, about the ethics of selling the place, and if you do, of course you don't want someone to buy it who is not informed of the dangers there. And clearly, in the natural, it would seem like, well, no one will buy it in those conditions. And sadly, maybe no one will, but maybe someone will, or maybe God will do something else remarkable. But the main thing is you need to trust in the Lord with all your heart, because there's not much man can do for you unless law enforcement decides to get serious about this. I'm very sorry about your circumstances. I'm also sorry to say I'm out of time for the show. I'm off the air here in 30 seconds. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday, open up the phone lines for calls and questions and such. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, that's how we stay on the air. You can go to our website and just click on the donate button. It's pretty easy. Of course, you have to have some money to give to do that. But, or you can send a check. The address is at the website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us, and God bless you.